21 and a half minutes now after the hour on a Tuesday morning, and that means a well, didn't last week. Tuesday didn't mean a conversation with Dr. Don Clark. He was on the road, but he's back. Back home in Garden Valley, Texas, where he's tending his grapes and talking to us on this Tuesday morning. Don is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, a vigneron, and a vintner. And I'm not sure how many other titles he has on his business card, but it's an 8.5 by 11 sheet now. And the man, it's too big to put in your business card file. Don, welcome home. I'm glad did you have a nice trip? You did a big circuit around the country, kind of.
Well, I did have a nice trip. It was a lot of traveling because I flew to Seattle and flew over to Cleveland and then drove from Cleveland to Minnesota and then flew back down from Minnesota here. So it was, it was a lot of traveling, but had two board meetings. And then in Cleveland, saw a production, a dance production, produced and put on by my daughter, one of my daughters, called Bareface, Till We Have Faces. It's the last book that C.S. Lewis wrote, and it's about Psyche and Cupid, but really about Psyche's sister. It was quite interesting and a beautiful production.
You know, I was not aware of that book. I'm remiss. I'm going to have to go look at it now. It sounds like a Greek mythology story.
Well, it's kind of Greek mythology. That's what C.S. Lewis used, the Greek mythology part of Psyche and Cupid. Cupid is really not much in the picture, if at all. But Psyche's sister, it's the struggle between not so much Psyche, but her sister that, her sister goes from kind of a possessive type of love to more of the love that Psyche had, which was a pure love. So. Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to envision this as a dance performance, and it must have been like, what, ballet? Was there live music with it?
Well, contemporary dance, there was music. Mm-hmm. There was some narration that kind of helped you along with the storyline. Mm-hmm. And there was some video clips because they videoed other dancers. So there was only two of them dancing, but interdispersed, there was some video of other dancers dancing or dancing, performing type of things that filled in the story for you as well.
Okay, I've never seen a performance like that. That would be interesting. David, have you ever been to was it in a church setting, Don?
No, this was in a theater downtown in Cleveland.
David, have you ever seen one of those?
No, I haven't.
It's like an art form I'm ignorant of here.
Yeah, there was a woman who was who had a dance school in Crosby and was a member of the church and was a minister of dance or something like that. Sounded like an honorary position. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while, she would do just brief moments of somebody dancing across the front of the church, but I was always difficult to make the connection. So,
well, dancing almost can express emotions strongly, like music does, but in a different way. And I think maybe it's a more aggressive way to demonstrate or to portray an emotional reaction to a situation or a person. That could be it could be quite a thing. But he got home safely, and now we're confronting. This is not a worldly topic either, although it's pretty basic stuff. And we've talked about the nature of irreducible complexity before, and how science in its early stages began looking at how God made the universe, how he functions, how he put things together, what his design was, what his plan was. And as they got smaller and smaller and smaller in their ability to see things and to analyze things, largely thanks to inventions like telescopes and microscopes and lenses and and then electron microscopes and electronics now, they expected to find that the smaller the thing they were examining, the simpler it would be. Don, it hasn't turned out that way, has it?
It hadn't turned out that way at all. I mean, it's the more we look, the more we discover, and the more we say, we should say, wow, this is amazing. and they are saying, excuse me, they are saying, wow, this is amazing. For example, the topic of the, you know, discussion today is on ATP synthase. So this is a complex group of proteins that synthesize ATP. Well, what is ATP? ATP is the, if you learn in your biology class, it's the energy source of the cell. It's made in the mitochondria, but every cell in your body needs energy to run on. And you would think, okay, glucose, but glucose actually gets transformed. The energy in the glucose that you take in gets transformed into ATP by this cluster of enzymes called ATP synthase. And what this is amazing, because here again you have, it's a rotary, it's basically a rotary engine.
Do you remember the Wankel engine from a few years ago?
Absolutely.
Yeah, the RX-7 was a sports car powered by a Wankel rotary engine, and it was just the rage in engineering circles for a long time until they ran up against pollution problems. And now, as far as I know, they've stopped using it. Maybe they're still experimenting with it, but they could take a lesson from this little energy conversion unit that we're stocked to the gills with internally, aren't we? Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's just fascinating, because you have the rotor, which is made up of course protein units, several protein units, and it rotates in the center, and then you have another protein that wiggles back and forth and actually helps to create the ATP by joining adenosine diphosphate, or ADP, with phosphate to create the adenosine triphosphate.
Let me ask you a question now. These are not allegorical tools you're using to describe this thing. This is really a physical thing of substance that spins, right? This is something that science can observe. Yes, it's not just chemicals; it's matter, it's solid stuff.
Well, they're made up of they're made up of proteins, and the central cluster of proteins spins, and it doesn't spin slowly. This is
but it's
amazing things.
It's physical, not just chemical.
Oh, it's absolutely physical.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. It is absolutely physical, and these proteins in the center that are spinning can spin up to 42,000 RPMs, revolutions per minute, 42,000. Now, a race car that's been fine-tuned and designed to run very fast, it spins at 10,000 RPMs. A regular car can spin, well, okay, maybe 4,000, maybe 5,000, but the faster you go, the parts want to fly away from each other.
Mm-hmm, yeah, round and round.
And so you got to do special things in order to make things work at a fast rate. But this, like I said, can spin up to 42,000. And the other amazing thing about it is that this little engine, if you will, it's a synthesizing engine, is nearly 100% efficient, which, of course, our engines are nowhere close to 100, percent, maybe 50%, 50%, they would say, well, that's a pretty good efficiency you're getting out of there. In other words, the fuel that you're putting in gets transmitted into what you're trying to accomplish. So with a race car, 50% of the energy that goes into the race car is transmitted to the rotation of the engine spinning at 10,000 RPMs. With these, with this cluster of enzymes, if you will, nearly 100% of the energy gets transmitted. So with a race car, what happens to the other 50%? Well, it gets used up in, it produces heat. And so we know that, gee, you got to cool your engine down or otherwise it's going to melt. Well, that's where the inefficiency comes in. There is no heat generated with this rotary, enzyme system, if you will, the synthetic synthesis system, which is the amazing part. I mean, the amazing part is that, one, you've got a rotary engine in your in every cell of your body, or multiple thousands of rotary engines, but the other is that this is 100% efficient. So, you know, the evolutionists looking at this and say, wow, you know, over billions of years and over the trials and errors and in everything that it took to create this thing, it produced a nearly perfect, if not perfect, way of synthesizing this very important molecule, ATP, that the energy of which is used in all of the cells. Without ATP, you would be dead. Everybody
would
be
dead. I have another question. I have a question. This might be a little metaphysical. So is this this rotary engine a machine, or is it a living thing?
It's a molecular machine. You see, it's a molecular machine. It makes up, it's one tiny little part in our cells and in our bodies that help us to be who we are physically. You know, of course, if you want to talk about the metaphysics, so you know, man is made up of body, soul, and spirit. Or three parts, just like God is made up of three parts, by the way. So man is made up of three parts. And so this, the ATP synthase, this little rotary engine, is part of our body, our physical form. So our physical form, which obviously includes our brains and nervous system and heart and everything, and then when you get down into the cellular level, you finally find this thing. But it's made up of proteins, like, you know, our body's made up of, we got a lot of different types of proteins. There's muscle proteins, there's nerve, you got nerve cells there. They've got proteins, they've got fatty acids and all kinds of stuff, going on. They also have enzymes, by the way, which use ATP in order to transmit the neurological signal. But the amazing thing, one of the amazing things in the point about this ATP synthase is that this rotary engine would not function unless all the pieces were there. So we're talking about probably 20 or so different types of, or 20 protein units at least, that have to be all there at the same time for it to function. Now think about it. You have this complex structure in our mitochondria, and it's producing this energy molecule called ATP. Without the energy molecule, no cell in the body would be able to exist. And so therefore, this whole subunit, this whole unit, has to be there from the very beginning. Otherwise, you wouldn't have life. So how do you explain that? Other than that there had to be a designer who designed it from the very beginning, to function the way it functions. Absolutely, from the very beginning. So from the very beginning of life, this had to be there. So that means it could not have evolved. There's no way that this could have evolved.
One part of this thing had no reason for being. You know, one component of this ATP, these are like turbines. They're energy conversion units that take glucose and convert it to ATP, which powers our bodies. So it's like a steam turbine that takes water power and converts it, say, to electricity.
Yes, but it does it 100% efficient,
mm-hmm.
or nearly. I mean, which, you know, of course, your steam turbine doesn't, because it's, you know, the heat is being dissipated.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, the rotational energy that's being produced is then converted into electrical energy and energy through the magnetism and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. But that's not very efficient. But this is 100% efficient. So, you know, we can't even design anything close to this.
Well, one of the researchers here, Stephen Meyer, has made some comments. He has a book on this called Signature in the Cell. And he places, this says part of the article, by the way, there's a link to this article in the chat window at Broken Road, if any of you would like to peruse or look at some of the internal links in this article. But the researcher places the chance of information randomly coming together to form the building blocks of life at 1 in 10 to the 41,000th power. Now, for you mathematicians, you can envision that. It's one with a what do you call the little thing up there? The the little number.
Superscript.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's got a 1 followed by 41,000 zeros. And a bunch of commas in there, every 3. So those are the odds of this happening in an evolutionary sort of way. So you wouldn't...
from a probabilistic point of view, science or mathematics would say that anything 10 to the 50th power is impossible.
Hmm.
Okay, so this is 10 to the
41,000th power. So, yeah, I would don't bet on it. Okay, the odds are
yeah. So if it that's just from a mathematical point of view, that this stuff, you cannot imagine. I mean, you could imagine. The human mind is fantastic, and we can imagine all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it's if you're using logic and you're trying to scientifically determine what the probability of this coming together is, and then truthfully looking at it, you're saying this is impossible. This couldn't have happened just by pure chance. That there had to be some type of intelligent designer that actually designed this from the very beginning. And this intelligent designer had to be smarter than we are, because we can't design anything like this or as efficient as this, and certainly not as small as this. Maybe there's a being out there that is smarter than us, and to have done all of this. And this is just a tiny part. This is such a tiny part in ourselves that if we continue to look, and it's like, gee whiz, this just expands. It's not even linear, it's exponential, the complexity.
That's the word I was looking for, exponent. That's what I was looking for. I couldn't thank you for solving that riddle. I'm sitting here chewing. Why can't I think of that word? Exponential, exponent. Yeah, that's what that number. This particular idea of irreducible complexity is stumping scientists who heretofore have, and in fact, it's converted researchers and scientists who used to be fans of evolution. Now they say it can't be. Darwin had to be all wrong. This is, it just does not, it falls apart. And so they can conclude, some of them, that, okay, this was designed, but what's the next logical step? I mean, what's the difference between a designer, an anonymous designer, and a creator God?
Well, yes. Here's the problem. With that, because you have folks, the evolutionists will say, oh yeah, of course it was designed. This, the planet Earth, was seeded from outer space.
Oh.
And so there, we got the designer from outer space. He comes in, there's, you know, there's supernatural people that come in and seed it from outer space. And so that's why we have so much.
Then I would ask how they come to be.
Well, we don't want to ask that question because obviously they had to be seeders from other planets seeding their planet. Mm-hmm. And so the process goes until Ignosium. They're just pushing back the problem, obviously, mm-hmm. when they say things like that, and not coming up to the fact that, you know, we as Christians and we who have, excuse me, read Genesis chapter 1, understand who the designer is. And the designer is God, is Elohim. He is the designer. In the beginning, Elohim, or God, created the heavens and the earth. So the first sentence in the Bible, you know, tells us who the designer is and who the creator is. And he who creates out of nothing created all things visible and invisible, you know, things that we can see and things that we can't see. That's who the designer is. So we have the answer to the question, who is the designer? But people just are so against any form of acknowledging that there is a God out there that they will refuse to accept, even in the more and more evidence that we get to say that there is a supernatural designer, and he is the one, you know, he is the God of the Bible, who loves us unconditionally, and who wants to have a personal. Now, this is the real, you know, a real revelation is that he wants to have a personal relationship with us. He created us so that special. We're not animals. We didn't evolve from animals, but he created us special. He created us in his image so that he could have a relationship with us.
And, of course, that's the essence of the message that Jesus brought. That was the revelation that he alerted us to, his new kingdom. And it just seems to me it would make a whole lot of sense. It would really help science along if they would just accept that as a given. And it seems that they had that locked into their psyches in the beginning, the early scientists did, in wanting to investigate. I mean, they accepted Genesis 1. You can differ a little bit in your interpretations from that point, but it seems to me that everything in the world points to that Creator, and it'd be a good place to start, and they can get a lot farther. And I have to thank Mazda for using rotary engines and bringing that all to our attention.
And, yeah. Amen.
Talking with Dr. Don Clark from Garden Valley, Texas. Don, a biochemist, and just a blessing for us here. I hope you enjoyed the conversation this morning. And Don, what can we expect you back next Tuesday?
Yes, I'll be here.
Oh, I'll look forward to it. Okay. You have a good week. We'll talk to you then.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Very good.
See you, Don.
So long.